This is an ArmorPod production. Send all production inquiries to armorpod@gmail.com.
This is FNX.
In lieu of recording an intro, because I'm fucking lazy. Sorry, Josh. I thought I would talk to somebody who I know, who's a real piece of shit. Ladies and gentlemen, Benny English.
I am a piece of shit and a cocksucker. Team cocksucker, I believe.
If you had one phrase to describe yourself, would it be piece of shit or cocksucker? Which comes first?
See, a cocksucker would make people happy, wouldn't it? So a piece of shit.
Piece of shit, huh?
Yeah. Because nobody likes that.
There are times when, especially at Platinum, where I appreciate you being a piece of shit because you're always there with my water. And I like that. I get parched when I'm competing against the likes of Sketch.
Who doesn't? A lot of people go off to the bar. But I remember when you first gave me your water bottle, I was actually holding it like Paul Bearer's urn during the match in the background.
There we go. Well, you know, and that was a spur of the moment thing. We didn't plan that.
No, I was talking to Cadman a fair bit. But
see how these beautiful things come organically?
Oh, we are beautiful people.
Benny English, let's get down to brass tacks.
Why not?
What have you been doing these days?
Thankfully, since promoting ended for me, nothing much. I've actually been enjoying that. But
exactly. So when you got rid of, not got rid of, when you relieved yourself of the obligation of promoting
a regular wrestling show,
you sold the rights to Warzone Wrestling, correct?
Yes, I certainly did.
So you do not own any of it anymore?
No, I don't. I do feel like this is some kind of legal thing that's going to come back and bite me on the ass. No, I don't. I don't own any of it anymore, thankfully.
Okay, so I'm doing this on behalf of Lord Mark Williamson.
Yeah.
Trying to find any loops in the contract. So how much of a relief was that on your life?
Man, it was huge. Two things. See, when you run a promotion, if you're at this level, I was running four shows a year, but at the same time, I wanted quality. So you are spending money to bring people in, you're doing all this stuff. It was just tiring more than anything else. I was working a full-time job and being a dad. And on occasion, because I live an hour away from my parents and my sister, so going to visit them, I ran out of time in the day. I was just tired constantly. It just wasn't fun.
But couldn't you just give up your family and run wrestling shows all the time?
That has crossed my mind quite a lot. You know, simple, like I'm just going to go pick up a pack of sugar, but it's pretty easy to find me as well.
So now that you've sold Warzone, you managed to find yourself a nice British leather jacket. I assume you purchased that with funds that you acquired from selling Warzone Wrestling.
Oh, yeah.
And then since then, you've been terrorizing people.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about it.
Oh, I mean, you should know. I've been working with your good self for the last year.
Yeah.
That was a nice turn of events. Working with Aaron O'Malley over in Perth.
Yeah. Who is he's a real cocksucker.
He is, but, you know, he's my kind of cocksucker.
Yeah.
That sounds bad. But, yeah, man, even Chris Weiss over in Perth, always enforcer. See what? We got accused of being a clique once, me and Enforcer, a two-person clique. Yeah, we got accused of that. We're not sure, but apparently it shows. And you two are a clique. No, I think that's just two friends that like chatting to each other. But
You know, Enforcer likes you when he talks to you.
Yeah. Well, I've seen him where he doesn't. Have you seen the limp-handed handshake?
Yes.
He looks the other way. That's saying something, you know?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, but no, that'd be
he's a cocksucker too.
Oh, man, is he ever.
Speaking of cocksuckers, in your promoting experience, have you ever come across Tom Chocolate and Russell Merch Printing?
Ah, the ultimate cocksucker, Tom Chocolate. Yeah. Now, you want to know something?
What?
I love Tom Chocolate. He's the nicest guy ever.
Really?
I like him.
Tell me about your dealies. In all fairness, he sponsors this podcast.
Well, bugger me with a fish fork.
Go figure.
You've just hit me.
I just bring him up because I like him.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay. One story he's going to be really embarrassed by, but I'll get to that. I actually remember when I worked over in for EPW Adelaide that became NWA Adelaide that became Wrestle something, Wrestle Fest or so. I'm sorry, guys over there, I just don't know the name. You keep changing it, but that it is an actual cool fed. You know, you've got Damien Slayer there, you got Robbie Eagles, Robbie Hart as well is there. Havoc. No, they can't afford Sketch. But they've, you know, like guys like Havoc, Jag. Jag basically is home fed there. But anyway, so I met him there and he was the commissioner. And basically I ran him out of town on the show. All he had to do was mention his name and it got a pop. So I always mention his name.
Oh, so he's beloved in the area.
Yeah, I don't know how the shows are now where he sits on it and stuff, but man, back then.
At one time, he was an over babyface.
He was, and he wasn't on the show. I just gloat about how I took him out and then, and I was, oh, okay. But he came to work for Warzone for a very brief time. He managed some tall goof, and basically, he decided to adopt a Southern American accent and came out. trying to woo Mike Peterson, asked him to sign on the dotted line, which unfortunately haunts him. I don't know if it's to this day, but it sure as hell haunted him for a couple of years. But man, he's cool. Like even with Warzone, the acquisition change, when they were looking for a new logo, he went out of his way. He made one. I don't know if they went with it, but he just did it out of the kindness of his heart. And I love that one. The one he did was awesome. So.
See, you're kind of killing the vibe of my show here, Ben. Because,
well, being nice.
Yes, because
I've got to be nice to Tom Chocolate.
The idea is he sponsors the show, but I don't actually buy merch, so I don't get anything.
I don't buy merch.
I know, but
I'm not Mark.
Usually I just talk shit about the guy.
And you can talk shit about him, but I mean, like, I've just pointed out there that the guy can't cut a promo. You know, he's just doing a Southern accent.
But he's generally... friendly guy. He does quick, prompt service.
I have not spoken to him in about 3 years. However, I could assume that he is still a lovely man.
So he has a reputation of excellence spanning a long time.
Oh, clearly.
Okay, fair enough.
I won't buy his merch.
When's your next appearance?
Next appearance. It's always a good question because I've got a memory like a sieve. But in HPW, you could generally find me haunting the halls there. I'm hopefully going to be there at the end of this month. If not then, I'm definitely going to be there in February. We've also got Platinum's Return. You and I are going to be going down there and causing our usual cocksucker piece of shit behavior.
Whose ass am I going to kick?
I haven't had a chance to have a look, but you know what? I think JXT definitely needs to get kicking the balls. I know, yeah. Cadman's got him, but you know, I do enjoy it. I mean, you remember what we did to him and Ryan Rowland's Australian Suicide last year?
Yeah, fuck those guys.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think they're the two main shows I'm on. And, of course, Warzone is going to be coming up at the end of February, which I'm also looking forward to. I usually am seen haunting the place as well.
But this time, you don't have to worry about paying the rent or keeping the lights on or anything like that. You just get to come and cause mayhem and get your shit
in. I actually usually seen haunting backstage, just being very rude to people.
Now, how are you going to interact with Lord Mark Williamson, the new owner? I mean, he wrote you a check.
Signed on the dotted line.
Yeah, signed on the dotted line. Yeah. But what happens if you show up and he's like, Benny, long time no see, pal. Missed you. Hey, I need you to mop that floor.
Hey, Benny, how are you? Yeah. You know what? Me and Dubs go back a very long way. Very long way. Right. So, yeah, but then again, I go a long way with a lot of people I dislike.
Look, I like Mark.
I do too. I mean,
all I'm saying is he promised the world and then he got me into a situation where I had to fight Peterson, Carlo, and...
Became a nightmare, almost.
And Pitbull. Yeah, it became a nightmare. Sure, it became a nightmare for fucking me. Because Mike Peterson is fucking jacked, and he fucked me up.
Well, here's a million-dollar point. If you had me there, how much better would it have been? You would have had someone that watches his back. You've never been in that situation at Platinum, have you?
No.
No. There you go. So, I mean, like I said, but Mark Williamson is a good manager. He's almost as good as me.
Well, so far he's one for one. I mean, he did get me a title shot against Pitbull, but let's be honest, I deserved it anyway.
Yeah,
based on what I did 10 years ago, and I would have beat him anyway. So, you know, really, he doesn't get a point for that. And he put me in a shitty situation in that December event, and you know, I'm still kind of pissed about it.
Yeah, no, I did. To be honest with you, I saw it as a hate crime. To be honest with you, there's a bunch of Australians against an American. I thought that was a hate crime. That just proves what kind of a racist place that we have to deal with.
I'm just trying to make wrestling great again in Australia.
You are. You are. Well, you know what you're doing with your keen fashion sense with that jacket. If a man has his country's colours on a jacket, I personally think that's the way to go. I think that shows you a step in his commitment.
You know where I got that jacket?
Where?
Not from fucking Wrestle Merch Printing. I'm joined here today by one Mike Altamira. Thank you, sir, for coming to my home.
I'm not going to say it's a pleasure because that's the most boring line on any podcast that someone can say, or thanks for having me, Ali. But it is indeed a pleasure to be in your presence, and I'm looking forward to seeing what direction this conversation is going to flow in.
It was pretty good, though. My wife made eggs. You know, we had some coffee.
Quality eggs, quality coffee, highly recommended, worth the trip out this way.
Costco. That's where we got it from. That's the secret.
Buying
bulk.
That's
the secret. So I started recording when you were mid-conversation. I'm going to preface this by saying that I listened to your podcast, and you had a conversation on it about boxing talent. Now, you were in the boxing world.
Yes, sir.
And you were talking about the type of talent that you would book for certain positions in the boxing world because of the realities of what draws money. And it struck me as so parallel to pro wrestling that I thought it would be a good conversation to have with you because you've had a foot in both worlds. So with that said, tell me, what's the money-making formula?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, not just the million dollar question.
I know, no pressure.
I think it's knowing your market. So you say in professional wrestling, you got to know who you're promoting to, whether it's an independent structure. And you know yourself, there's multiple structures of running an independent company. You might have a show that's geared towards having 200 people. You have another one that might be targeting, you know, 1,500 in attendance. Then you've got your next tiers, 4,000, 5,000, 10,000 people. And you can have a different structure to each of them in respect to how you position certain talents, you know, and what essentially you're selling, how you're presenting the brand, the familiarity that your patrons are going to have. It's very different structuring a company, say, that you promote to 200 people locally every month than it is promoting 2 one-off shows a year where you might be looking to attract, you know, 1,500 people. The way you're going to promote them, the way you're going to structure, the way you're going to run storylines. I think the key is having personnel firstly, and then from the personnel behind the scenes, having the talent that believe in the vision you have for the show and all work towards the same cause, which is having a terrific product put out there on that night.
So we're going to pull back a bit. Your role in the boxing world is what?
It's been evolving, but right now my role is as a promoter, as an executive director of MJA Entertainment. But I've worked all different kinds of roles. I've worked as an athlete manager. Sorry, I've worked as a consultant for major companies, an agent, a matchmaker, a trainer on occasion in my younger years. So I've been able to see the industry from many different vantage points. And I forgot also I've doubled up on work commentary as well. But nowadays, my primary role is as the executive director of a promotional company.
So you are in a position or have been in a position at times to choose, say, specific fighters for certain opportunities because of the position that you're in. Matchmaking sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. Or the market you're dealing with.
Okay.
And it's interesting because I'll jump in for a moment, and then if this is taking you slightly off course, steer me back.
No problem.
But there used to be, when boxing was more prevalent on Fox Sports a few years back, because now they're not running so many local Australian shows live. But the guy that was head in Fox Sports who was running the content was a guy that a lot of people in the wrestling world would be familiar with, Andy Raymond. And a lot of matchmakers used to pitch matches to him that they thought would get his approval to run on TV. They will work into what they thought were his needs. So they would look at records. They'll look at Australian versus Australian, and they would put one guy forward who's, say, 20 wins, 2 losses against another guy, 15 wins, no losses, and on paper it looks like a great fight. But stylistically, it's a nightmare of a contest. It's just two people that aren't going to mesh well in the ring.
Mm.
I've always prided myself on finding those two guys, even if the records are a little bit shaky or whatever when you look at them comparatively. I try to find that fight that has the perfect balance, that has the right mix in style, that creates a great spectacle for the audience. Sometimes it's tricky because when you're working in the confines of other people, they're giving you their perspective of what they think works. But sometimes what works on paper doesn't work in principle.
So it would be a fair statement to say that there are certain times where you are in a position to extend certain opportunities to boxing talent based on the specific needs of the event and or the nature of the opportunity. So, for instance, you are in a generic example, a market that really prizes blonde-haired fighters for whatever reason.
Ivan Drago.
You would look for somebody that fit that bill for that specific role for that opportunity, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even like we were talking about this off air earlier, like for example, I've worked events in China and I know that the direction I've been given with the budget is to bring, you know, a sideshow. So they want the big show versus Aki Bono from WrestleMania.
Yeah, spectacles.
They want the spectacle. They want the Bob Sapp. And I'm looking at it and thinking, you know, if it's 50 grand, I've got 50,000 better and smarter ways to spend the money. But it doesn't matter. That's what you've ordered. So that's what I'm going to deliver. So I try and deliver the most high-end version of that spectacle that's possible. But sometimes you've got to work to the needs of your clients. So you give them what they want, even if it's not per se how you would book things.
Mm-hmm. So how does that translate to the wrestling world? In my mind, certain talents are afforded certain opportunities based on the needs of the market, the needs of the promotion, who the promotion trusts to carry the ball, so on and so forth. It works the same in boxing, does it not?
Pretty much so. I mean, it's ultimately about what's found to be appealing in the marketing you're dealing with mm-hmm. and what's sellable to the people. So I think those two things definitely translate back and forth between the two.
The only difference is in pro wrestling, it's a worked finish, and we have the luxury of creating anything we want. Whereas in boxing, you are somewhat limited to the actual outcome of the contest, and it's very difficult to predict a legitimate contest at times.
Yeah, there is people in the boxing world who have worked finishes. Usually they get found out pretty fast.
Mm. Is that like a big deal? Like if you work a finish, you lose credibility?
Oh, you're done and dusted if you do that.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing is the industry sold on legitimacy.
Yeah.
So as soon as you compromise the legitimacy, your reputation's out the window. There was a guy, Bobby Middleman, really, really smart matchmaker, real sharp-minded guy. He actually was the first manager of Oscar De La Hoya.
Mm.
He got done fight fixing. He had probably about 30, 40 fights in the United States that he supposedly, I'll say allegedly fixed. He was bringing guys to Denmark and places like that, and there's a lot of suspicion on those fights. Once it came out in the open that he was fixing, he was done and dusted. I mean, it's very, very hard to recover in the business once you've hit that point.
But that's kind of like, you could make a parallel to professional wrestling in the 1960s, for instance. It was always dodging accusations of being worked. Do you think it's at all possible that aspects of... I've always had this theory, because there's money to be made.
Yeah.
So when money, to especially the huge level, is concerned, you always wonder about that sense of corruption. And if I just push this guy for a couple fights, then feed him to this champ over here, I'm going to get more returns on my pay-per-view.
But the corruption hits in other areas. It's not necessarily in the fights being fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how you can compromise rankings. So
to determine who gets the fights.
Yeah, so in boxing, there's four sanctioning bodies, four main ones. There's the IBF, the WBC, the WBA, and the WBO. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it in professional wrestling, what world titles immediately generate revenue? What creates worth? The IWGP,
mm-hmm.
WWE title,
mm-hmm.
The TNA.
Sure.
So whatever title you're holding at that particular moment is going to create worth. In boxing, there's ways that you can manipulate the rankings. You can take certain fights. You can put on certain fight, bring in certain titles. Your guy still needs to be able to fight, but there is ways, if you've got enough capital behind you, where you can get a C-plus talent to A-grade opportunities through the fact that you can compromise the ratings a little bit, and all they got to do is beat other C-plus talent or C-minus talent. So there is comparison in that respect, I guess.
Dude, to me it sounds very similar.
There's carny involved in both avenues.
Yes, but it's not being carny. It's recognizing the landscape.
Yeah, that's,
hey,
that's
true. Hey, they need tag team wrestlers. Let's be a tag team. It's that simple. I don't know. I was struck by the aspect of marketability.
Yeah.
If a fighter is marketable, because I went to a boxing event that you were kind enough to invite me to, and I noticed that some talents were being pushed. There was entrance music and, you know, there's a big whoopla. And then there were some jabrones that were there to put them over. But they weren't doing it, obviously, as a fix. But it looked like maybe one side was designed to look better than the other.
Stylistically, it's matched where the local guy should be winning comfortably.
Yes. But and even in the presentation of the local guy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Because there's not that consistency of the branding and the marketing behind both guys. They're only looking out for the local product.
Of course.
And until more money is generated in the industry, that's a trend that will follow, because management works like this in terms of fighters in this country. Oftentimes, you got nobody investing in you. You'll get your spot on the card based on how many tickets you can sell. So I'll put it to you like this in wrestling terms.
You just did.
Right. If you sell 100 tickets,
uh-huh.
and you selling 100 tickets means you're getting on the show, and you control your spot on the show, are you going to job yourself?
If you're asking me, yes. But well, if you're asking most people, no.
Maybe you're meant to. But if you're, you know, if you're going and selling all your family and you're generating, say, 20, 30 grand in tickets, your team is going to make sure you got the right opponent to make you look good. If there's the money in the industry to say, hey, here's $20,000, you don't got to sell a ticket, then the promoter has the clout over you to say, okay, this is who you're going to be facing tonight.
Yeah.
Then you got some guys whose mentality is different, because you got some guys who will say, yeah, I'm going to go sell 200 tickets, but I want to fight the best in the world because I want to test myself. But you can see, because of the way the industry is run in this particular country, the promoters aren't necessarily promoters per se. A lot of them are event coordinators and they're subcontracting spots on the show. It's akin to someone subcontracting 10 spots on a wrestling show and saying, okay, if you sell this many tickets, you got the main event. You sell this many, you got the semi-main event.
You know how many main event matches I had with guys that sold 50, 60 tickets at an OVW show that had had like 6 matches in their life? No, it makes complete sense. And that's why the system was set up that way. If you're moving fucking tickets, you get a spot. Now, are you moving tickets because you had worldwide publicity, or because you're a great looking guy, or because you're daring, or because everybody loves your moonsault? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, do you sell tickets? And that's you would say that that would be a fair comparison to bridge the two worlds between boxing and wrestling.
Yeah, I think at the independent level,
mm-hmm.
definitely. You know, at the next level, you obviously got, when you got TV, when you got mainstream sponsors, it's a whole different ball game.
Explain that to me from the boxing standpoint. How does it become a whole new ball game?
Okay, well, for example, if you've got a fighter who is, say, a top 10 guy, a legitimate top 10 guy in his weight class, they'll be on the radar of international TV networks. So the likes of, say, in the United States, HBO,
mm-hmm.
Showtime. In the United Kingdom, you got Sky Sports. Once they get on that radar, then the TV companies will come forward and put forth either certain fights or certain package deals of what they're willing to pay for them to fight on their network.
Because they want to feature them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they hit the level, the elite level of what they want involved with their boxing content. So you've got that. Also, promotionally, you've got companies at the next level that can attract, you know, major league sponsors. So like I've outlined here with the company I'm heading, one of the main sponsors we have behind our cause is Mercedes-Benz. So when you have major league brand names like that, you then got to present an A-grade product.
Yeah.
You can't present an A-grade product by forcing the guys on the show to sell tickets. You have to invest to bring up the next level. You know, it's like this. John Cena or The Rock ain't going to come and say, hey, Mike, yeah, that's cool. I'll be on, you know, I'll sell you $1.5 million in tickets and pay me $800,000 and you can have the rest and guarantee me the main event. That shit ain't happening. So it's a whole different level of promotion, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Although I do remember times where we got dropped off by the van at a certain school. We had to hand out all these flyers for a show that was 2 hours afterward. So I'm supposed to be the fucking Iraqi heel, goddammit. Anyway. But no, you're 100% right. But again, it strikes me because at the end of the day, both businesses, whether boxing, be it an athletic competition that's legitimate, or professional wrestling, which is the art of storytelling through a physical form, either way, both are designed to draw money. And correct. What draws money in certain positions with certain talents is very much similar in both worlds. Now, let's say you have... because I'm going to go back to that conversation we opened this with about successful companies.
Yeah.
Let's say you have all your eggs in one basket in terms of you got a big marquee fight. Let's say a world heavyweight title fight. One of your fighters is in this fight. Let's say.
Yeah.
Not champion. Or maybe he is champion. And you have two other spots on that card. Let's say you got guys that are ready for that title shot themselves. Do you put those guys in those, that the guys that are not in the title shots, do you put them on the undercard and just have them go ham? Or do you maybe save them for a shot down the road?
No, you put your other guys in prominent spots.
Okay.
Because you have to be building what's beneath in your company as well. So that then they're prepared for the next level of sellability. Right. For example, this is going to run on delay, right? So
this would be weeks.
So if it's on delay, then I can speak openly about this because there's an announcement coming in the next 48 hours. So for example, I just signed the 2016 Olympic gold medalist at 152 pounds, 69 kilograms for Australians. Danyar Yelusinov from Kazakhstan. A guy like that, when I've got any major promotion, I need to be featuring him prominently on the card because I'm building his branding and his sellability down the line. So every chance to expose his talents, I'm going to put him there front and center. That way, say I'm promoting the world heavyweight title fight and I sell the television rights to 120 countries, probably 95 of them are going to pick up the undercard. I've got to make sure that on the fact that I'm selling the undercard, that I'm selling a product that's going to come back to us and benefit our company for the future as well.
So that's where you have those spots that you can feature guys that you can see a return on your investment in them.
That's right. And build them so that you're building them towards their payoffs in future.
I would argue that professional wrestling is the exact same fucking thing when done correctly.
It's true. It's, you know, you have a good point in that respect. I mean, even the way we structure shows. See, a lot of boxing shows, and it's been one of the things that I've been outspoken about from a promoter's perspective, because my history as a manager, my track record as a manager speaks of a different mentality, but you got to know how to switch gears. As a manager, they used to call me No Risk Mike because I call me up for a fight that I didn't like and I'm like, no, we ain't taking that fight. I ain't that stupid. And they learned that no was my favorite word. As a promoter, I've got to think of a different perspective. As a promoter, I've got to think, what kind of a spectacle are people going to pay to come and see?
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that from the start of my events to the close of my events, the show is entertaining, that there's competitive matchups, and that people are intrigued by every athlete showcased on the event. I can't be wasting spots. But it doesn't mean that because I'm not wasting spots or because I want people entertained by every fight, that I'm going to try and put every fight to hit at the same standard as the main event, because if you go and put six 12-round fights on a show, everyone leaves the building drained. It's overkill.
Can you repeat that one more time for dramatic effects? Just the last sentence.
If you put six main event 12-round fights back to back on a show, it's overkill.
Just like pro wrestling.
And it's, you know, I used to watch some of the old Ring of Honor shows, right? Like the early ones before guys like Adam Pearce and so forth were booking there and working behind the scenes. And all my friends would tell me how spectacular it was. But I used to get fatigued sitting there watching the VHS tape when I was five matches in.
I worked there in 2011 and I did the same. I got fatigued.
You know, when I spoke to Dowie, mm-hmm. you know, on my podcast, my now defunct podcast, about pro wrestling. And he was talking about ice cream flavors.
Yes.
And that's the same way that a wrestling product needs to run. And that's what I was saying earlier about everyone knowing their placing on a show. So if I'm opening a boxing show, I'm usually going to open with a 4 or 6 round fight, but make it a dynamic 4-6 round fight. Then the next fight after that, I might run with it. Okay, I've got this Olympian I need to feature. He's probably going to knock the guy out in 2 rounds, but it's a good showcase fight. After that, I start to build a little bit. I might put an 8 round fight, a good competitive 8 round. Next one after that, I put a solid 10 round fight. Then I'm working towards, then between that, I might have a live performance. You know, because I'm breaking into the Chinese market. In China, they love having a Chinese pop star or a live show, whatever it is at the halfway point. You run that, then you get into the business end of your program. The structure is parallel to what a professional wrestling structure should be.
I'm glad you're saying it, because I feel like a broken record. It makes total sense. Look, you... I've made comments about moonsaults before. If you see guys go out of the ring in the first match, if you see guys go through tables in the third match, if you see somebody juice in match 4, what do you expect your main event to do?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Exactly. And when they inevitably fail to cripple themselves, you've let them down based on what you've conditioned them for.
Absolutely. And you've deflated your audience by that point as well. Like I was saying, you get fatigued. Mm. Yeah, the other thing that I used to see a lot of in Australia, and it's somewhat geared away from that, but I used to see it in the Australian wrestling product, was people felt like as though if they opened the doors at 7, that they needed to hold you there till midnight.
Is that from too many matches or just disorganization? Or
both. Both. It's from a 10-minute intermission lasting 45 minutes, maybe because a promoter thought that they were going to sell another 8 T-shirts or another 5 hot dogs. It's from a lack of structure of how to pace the shows, maybe trying to appease everyone. So booking 10 matches when you know that you should only be structuring to 6. Mm. It's about people, I'm not going to say not having enough respect for the promoter or the booker, but not understanding the psychology, the true psychology of the business, and going into work for themselves. So when you're given 8 minutes in the opening match, if a guy goes and works 9.5 minutes, that's a problem. When a guy goes and works 15 minutes, that's a major league problem. In my opinion, if you go and disrespect me like that as a promoter or a booker, you jeopardize getting booked again. And the problem is that there used to be a structure in place where none of those things were really understood to the ground. People used to just go in and work for themselves, which is why you would see them moonsaults and dives outside the ring in the opening match. And why you'd see repeats of spots, why you'd see finishes repeated throughout. You know, a guy would land a 450 splash in the opening match as a high spot. And then when a guy tries to do it as a finish 5 matches in, it's dead.
And you're trying to spend all your time to put together this spectacular match that you're going to force feed this crowd to get the responses that you're trying to engineer at certain times. You're missing what they've been conditioned to right before you, because you're still putting your own shit together instead of watching the monitor. and seeing what the crowd is being fed. Absolutely. Because there is no such thing as a bad crowd. There are bad performers. There are bad workers. Because you are a conductor. And the crowd, the people that are paying money, the people who are, if you're running a free show in a park, the people who are watching, they are your musical instruments. And through your physical actions, you are conducting the band, bringing them up, taking them down, bringing them up, taking them down. That is in essence what we do. And if you don't understand that aspect, then you're definitely not going to understand what you were just touching on, which I very strongly prescribe to, which is knowing what your role is and doing that.
Exactly.
So that the it's a territory mindset. And I've talked about this a lot. There is no territory mindset outside of places where there is no territory. And where are their territories? WWE, New Japan, where the fuck else? That's about it. Impact, I guess, but all those guys work independent dates during the week.
You got the companies in Mexico, but they're still independent in structure.
But the point is, there's a dime a dozen. So yeah. It's a different mentality. So my business suddenly becomes, I need to get booked. Okay, how do I get booked? Well, I go get my shit in, and when I make people make noise, then the promoter will think I'm good, and then they'll pay me more money. Or the worst case scenario is I'll pay for my own travel, and I'll come to your show, and I'll work for free. So that then you condition promoters to not want to pay talent, so then they put on shit shows. Back to your analogy of you're going to put forward the A-plus show.
Absolutely.
So is it similar in the boxing world, or is it? I guess not, because it's a legitimate contest. So guys, it's kind of over their head sometimes why they're being put in certain situations. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. But there it's more on the promoter to put the right fights in place, or the matchmaker working for the promoter to put the right fights in place.
Do you have fighters going up in politics in the matchmaker all the time? Like, yo, dog, I should be getting this title shot, man. I don't know why he's black.
I've said this to people in professional wrestling. Like, I find it pretty straightforward to deal with people's mindsets in pro wrestling after dealing with the kind of individuals I've encountered in boxing. The kind of craziness and egos and bizarre conduct that I've been front and center to over the years is just next level. And here's the thing, Ali. Someone has a problem. What's the first thing? They don't want to sit and talk to you. They want to fight you. Someone's got an issue. Oh, no, we want it. We need another $1,000. I was at an event a few weeks ago in India, and thank God I matched 6 fights on the event, and everything I was running ran like clockwork. The main event was run by Frank Warren's office, and the opponent for Vijender Singh, who was a main talent, the opponent was a kid from Tanzania. As soon as they got there in New Delhi, they were hitting up the matchmaker of the fight. You know, maybe you can give us an extra G or two. Then every single day of the week, there was a different angle in which they were hitting him and threatening him and suggesting they were going to pull out of the contest. And these are things that just, they're a daily part of working in the professional boxing industry. It's the red light district of professional sports for a reason. So in that respect, yeah, the kind of strange behavior we encounter, it's probably at a slightly even more enhanced level than what you'd find in pro wrestling. And egos are rife. There's guys that might not be ready for a world title telling you they're ready. You know, I remember there was a guy that I managed. I got him to a world championship. Remember, there's 4 world titles. My business partner and I found a way to manipulate the rankings to get him in a position to win a world title. At that time, he was probably the 8th or 9th best fighter in his weight class. But it didn't matter. He had a belt. So he had, you know, real sellability on the world scale. He was a somebody. No matter what anyone could say about him, he was a world champion. We were building the brand and we're building him for a monster payday. I was lining him up for a $500,000 payday. Problem is, the guy got to a point along the journey where he thought he was the number one pound for pound fighter in the weight class.
He believed the hype.
He believed the hype. He believed what we sold. Have you watched Rocky III?
Yes. Have I watched Rocky III?
When Mickey says to him, they were bums. We were building the same Mirage, but
fuck that shit. Spider Rico was no bump. Anyway, go on. I'm sorry.
But if you're building the Mirage, you've got to make sure you're in full control. The athlete believed everything that was projected to him, lost his mind in the moment, went his own way of doing things, and his next fight, with all of us out the picture, he lost the world championship.
Ugh. If only he would have listened.
It's the breaks. That's the way the business is sometimes. But
Do you think it's human nature? Because there are certain guys that it doesn't matter how many times I tell them, they got to go touch the stove to know it's hot. Did you think that that's just a fundamental human being thing? That's not a wrestling thing. That's not a boxing thing.
I think
that's
so.
It's a human immaturity thing, right?
I think people want to believe they're the best.
Do you think it's a male thing too, where we don't want to ask for help and all that shit? My wife says that to me all the time. She's half-assed right, but not always.
Yeah, it's a macho way of thinking. And not a Randy Savage way of thinking, so to speak.
Who's your favorite wrestler?
That's a hell of a question. You know, I always think about these questions. Someone actually asked me that about boxing about 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me about 5 minutes because there's like my mindset on these things changes from day to day. There'll be one person I'll watch, and I'll be, yeah, man, I love watching their stuff. And then a week later, I'll be, no, I think I prefer this guy.
It's evolving. It's an evolving list.
Exactly. You know, and the thing is what the guys aerially can do now, they're as good as ever.
Yeah.
So sometimes I go and watch the old school stuff and I'm like, man, this is really, really slow.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, and I remember thinking about how amazing it was. And then I go back and watch. I'm like, I don't know. But you know what holds up? Is psychology.
Yep.
And so I've always been drawn to psychology. I don't know if I've got like there's one person I say, yep, this is a guy. But the guy that I can sit and watch all day is Jake Roberts. And the reason why is he ain't going and doing 50 flips, but you believe every movement with him. Whether it's his Mid-South stuff, whether it's WCW, WWF, whatever it is, you get drawn into the story of Roberts. Like his pre-WWF stuff
mm-hmm.
was phenomenal.
Yeah, down in Mid-South.
Yeah, you go any of his Mid-South stuff, the work with, you know, the likes of Terry Taylor,
mm-hmm.
just absolutely phenomenal. Then when he got there and he worked with Steamboat, next level. You know, guys like that, I always was drawn to the guys that weren't the main guy. Of course, you know, when I was a kid, I had all the Ultimate Warrior merch and that kind of a deal. But as I got older and started to understand the structure of professional wrestling, I respected more, in your terms, what you'd call the mechanics.
Yeah, the carpenters.
You know, so even like I said, I just mentioned Taylor. Always enjoyed watching Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'd say Roberts, Dynamite Kid.
Yeah.
Fantastic worker. I know so much he said about his character, but I'm only looking at the professional wrestler.
Yeah.
So just looking strictly.
Revolutionary for his time.
Absolutely. And his stuff still holds up. Then you got other guys from that era, you know, like Mark Roller, Rocco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another guy, underestimated guy, but a phenomenal talent. Then you got the Japanese guys. Muda, at his best, was phenomenal. Jushin Liger, always loved.
Yeah.
You know, even though he breaks the rules with a lot of things. Do you know who I loved? Hashimoto.
What about?
When Hashimoto chopped somebody, you believed it.
You may not be able to believe that professional wrestling is real, but you believed he was real.
You believe Hashimoto.
Yeah.
He was just phenomenal. You know, it's that intensity that he could bring to the ring.
Do you think that's missing in today's wrestling world?
Yeah, I see. I don't know where it's come from. Maybe it's come from the fact that, you know, people are working safer these days. Or thinking safer.
Do you think that I would go the exact opposite?
I'll say to you. You know, because you're in there. I think they work a style that looks safer.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like the stiff style, the good intentional stiff style is out the window. Guys are working lighter, but they're probably working more dangerous, but they work a style that looks safer.
Okay.
And when I'm watching something on TV and it looks safe, there goes the illusion of professional wrestling being real.
Hmm. Okay.
That's how I kind of perceive it, you know, that I don't know, like, if there's been, has it, is there a change in the ideology of how people go about working?
Well, the thing in pro wrestling is it's an interpretive dance.
Yeah.
So to speak. So there's no ironclad, you know, rule book. It's literally flavors of ice cream, but people tend to follow what they see on top.
Yeah.
So the WWE sets the trend. But the tide of the business turns at a slow pace, but it does turn. So like in my prime hiring years, it was about being an underwear model or, you know, being somehow related to somebody in the business.
Yeah.
The idea of, and developmental was something that was hidden, not acknowledged. We weren't on a fucking network, that I promise you. It was in obscurity, tucked away in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
The business has completely changed, right turn, to where now being an independent wrestler is an asset. Having passion in the business and doing it on your own and trying to perfect your craft is something that's sought after nowadays. So it's flipped on its head. They've opened new revenue streams by featuring NXT, their now developmental system, on, you know, a worldwide pay-per-view. So it, in that aspect, yes, it's changed. But the work rate and all that kind of stuff, that evolves too. And it, again, I come from a very structured territory background, you know, Southern wrestling. Everybody works their part on the card because it prepared me for how the big territories work.
Yeah.
If you get signed to WWE, trust me, you're going to be way better off knowing how to work to hard camera before you get there than 6 months in. It's a big difference. So little things like that, let alone the territory mindset, how to structure a third match on the card, you know, how to work your spot as the heel who's being built up to be the second heel in line to make the baby faces 6 months down the road, compared to you're the Goldberg baby face, how to work that spot. You know what I mean? Like, it's there's differences.
Yeah.
But it's a laboratory to learn those types of differences. So it's completely different. And what is acceptable then is not acceptable now, and vice versa. But nowadays, it's much more of the fans dictating to the wrestlers what they think they should be seeing, which is completely ass backwards. But that's the wrestling mindset. If you go to some indie shows and you get booed as a heel, then the promoter thinks you suck.
Yeah.
Explain to me how that works, pal. But, I mean, that's just, hey, man, it is what it is. And you have to be mindful too, because here's the thing: is you're a function of your experiences and what you've been exposed to in the past. Sitting next to you and talking to you about promotion of boxing is going to be way different than if I sat next to some, you know, guy who maybe put on a fight or two at the local YMCA 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
In terms of the scope of your knowledge and your experiences and what you can actually bring to a straightforward intellectual conversation. Pro wrestling is very similar to that, but that doesn't necessarily exist everywhere with people who are qualified to have that conversation. It's just the reality of the situation. So I appreciate your perspective from boxing, because as soon as I heard that, going all the way back to how we brought you on this show, was it seemed very parallel to pro wrestling in a lot of different ways. And I think it would behoove younger talent to understand why certain people get certain breaks at certain times.
Definitely. And it's about knowing how you're being showcased on the event.
Yeah.
Knowing your spot on the event, you know, and being appreciative of the fact that, you know, this show you might be second or third up, but if you impress, gradually you'll build to the semi-main event until you're in that top spot.
Wow. It's just so parallel. Yeah.
But it's all about earning it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, you see a guy come in the industry. I've seen it in this country plenty. A guy comes in the industry, he has potential. Promoters start using him straight away because they're excited of the fact that they've got a new toy.
Yeah.
The guy gets booked a whole bunch of shows. A year later, he's thinking he's deserving that main event spot. Mm-hmm. He might not realize there's been five or six guys that have been given more of themselves working beneath on the show that are just as prepared or more prepared than him to shift into those spots. If you as a promoter go and ignore all of them and place this guy in the main event, this fresh kid, you're going to draw a lot of heat upon yourself too.
But what if the kid's selling tickets?
If it's The Rock and it's someone that kind of charisma, you have to put him in that spot. If it's Goldberg, you have to put him in that spot.
But whose opinion of that talent? Because I'm sure you have talent that come and they pitch to you, I am the second coming of The Rock.
It's your team. You have to have, as the promoter, I've said this to you before. As the promoter, you've got to be fearless and you're going to make executive decisions with your team and stand by them. You can't be umming and ahhing and looking to everybody else as to how you're going to guide or how you're going to place your talent. You've got to make calls and you've got to commit to them.
They are so similar worlds.
It's unbelievable. And it's probably why I've always enjoyed working both industries. And I've never, like, I meet people in the boxing world and I say, I seen you work the wrestling event. You know, I seen you used to work in professional wrestling. You know, all that's fake, yeah? I'm like, yeah. What's your favorite movie? Rocky. You know that's fake, right? Kills them every time.
Kills them every time.
But the story is the same. The hero's journey is the same. The fact that people are drawn to storylines, good, evil, whatever, is the same.
I like the reflection of how bad of a host I am. That you were choking on water. And I said, no, goddammit, Mike, we're only at 42 minutes. You are not allowed a water break yet. That's how I run my show, pal. Anyway. Yeah, so fuck this China deal. Let's come over here. Let's you and I run weekly wrestling shows out in Bendigo. And, you know, we'll blow through about $100,000 in 6 months. We won't make any money. We'll deal with a lot of headaches and prima donnas. And we'll laugh all the way. What do you say?
Bendigo's was traditionally a gold mining town, right?
Yes.
So we better hit some of them gold mines before we go and invest it in professional wrestling. We better make sure that where we run our venue, it's like on an oil rig at least or something out that way. Otherwise, we're in trouble.
Give me your observations on the pro wrestling business.
In general or in general, this country?
Actually, no, give me in this country. And to be fair, you have been flying all over the world in the last 2-3 months. So
now I'm probably 2 or 3 months behind.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of really, really solid talent in Australia in terms of physical athletes. There's
sketch.
Number one. But he can't hear us, so it's okay. We've got a lot of talented guys, and you see that with the opportunities that are being accorded to people through our system. Australia's never been on the radar internationally that it is now.
Mm.
You know, when I was first around this business in like 1999, 2000, no one was getting booked in New Zealand, let alone in Japan, USA, anywhere else. If someone actually got on a plane back then and just attended WrestleMania, it was like out of this world. Now we've got our talents being featured over there. So we've come a long way. I think sometimes people in this country forget that. But there's still a lot of work to do. There's still education behind the scenes. Like I've said to you, and it's not just because I'm sitting here with you today, but we need more guys like yourself in the system out here that can educate people as to the psychology of the business, because psychology from an elite level down isn't being taught, and you're only going to know what you've been taught or what's been developed within your skill set. I feel like that's been lacking on the shows for years, which is why sometimes you go to an event and I look at it like this. Correct me if I'm wrong. If someone gave me a file of 6 matches and didn't tell me the order, I should be able to, within reason, be able to figure out where each match was on the card. I should be able to put that puzzle together for you.
You should be able to, theoretically, yes.
you look at a lot of shows in Australia now and you can't work that out. You might actually think the main event was a second match because the crowd's flat. You know, and that's the thing that, you know, people understanding their place on the card and going in to wrestle for the promotion and put on a great exhibition of themselves. 5 minutes, 6 minutes doesn't mean that you're not a good talent. It means that you're working your role. You should be able to get yourself over in 40 seconds, let alone 25 minutes.
Do you think it's because it's literally just a wild west of different promoters and independent contractors? There's no unifying system. There's no real territory.
And it's inconsistent because what you're allowed to get away with in one suburb, a promoter won't allow you to get away with it in the next. And a lot of these guys don't want to look at, they don't want to look themselves in the mirror and ask the hard questions, because that's the most frightening thing to do in life. What happens, Ali? You go give someone, people ask you for constructive criticism. Oftentimes, constructive criticism is just the guys with the person. What they want you to do is tell them how fantastic they are.
Put me over.
You go and give them your criticism. Now, the first thing I say to boxers when they come, what do you think of the fight? I'm like, I ain't going to tell you what you did well, because you know what you do well. So I'm going to tell you where you can improve. The people that listen to that are the ones that go on and supersede all their expectations. The ones that don't want to hear it out, that, oh, but did you see? Oh, but you see, he was awkward.
Yeah,
did
but.
Did you see he was grabbing
yeah,
me?
Yeah, but.
But did you
yeah,
see?
Yeah, but.
The ones that feed you those excuses are the ones the next time when they get defeated, you know, oh, you know, I didn't, I was fighting with my wife in the lead up and my weight cut was hard. They're filled with excuses and negativity no matter what. And they're limited in their thinking, so they're never going to grow. So it's about creating a culture in this country where the people are working towards a bigger picture and want to grow. And if they've got to become thicker skinned along the journey, that's the way it should be. Until we get there, we're going to have inconsistency with the work. We're going to have inconsistency with the bodies. And what I mean is, you got someone 6 foot six and 250 pounds and they're doing monkey flips because they don't know how to structure the match or say no to the other guy. You got people that are dominant personalities, perhaps with someone who's got a weaker personality, and they're telling the other person how the match needs to be. But how the match is, isn't how it should be to the characters of the two people on that show.
Oh, that doesn't sound familiar at all.
That's what I think. Like, there's so many positives in this country. Like, I remember years ago, it's probably in 2000, 2001, I had a friend of mine, Greg Prowse, I think it was. Yeah, Greg Prowse, I'm sure it was. He was talking to a few other people on like a forum, and they were discussing, you know, how do we put together a list of the top Australian wrestlers? And they couldn't even come up with 100 names. Now you can almost come up with 100 names in Victoria right now.
So, sketch.
Is he working another 99 gimmicks?
If he was, that list would be quick.
Exactly. But, you know, there's the wealth of talent there. There's the numbers in the talent, but it's about harnessing that talent so that we become something so much better than what we are.
Yeah. The way I can summarize it, or the way I would look at it is, look, it's never been more competitive than it is now in terms of indie guys actually having a real shot to go to WWE. So if you can learn some shit in advance that you're going to need to know once you're actually there, it's going to put you ahead of the curve and it's going to help you out. Your biggest hurdle as an Australian talent is getting a work visa.
Yeah.
I can't help you there. But if you can figure out how to work and how to give the company what they want, besides it's an entertainment company, they don't give a shit about your moonsault. If you can learn those things, it gets you ahead. And it gets you ahead and in a position to be successful. Bottom line. But if you can't take criticism, holy shit. I've had people get mad at me over Facebook who have unsolicited asked me for feedback, and I give them feedback, and then they're like, well, can't you give me something positive? I'm like, no. But if you want to put me to put you over, just say that in advance.
Exactly right.
I'll put you over for a nice,
I have the same thing happen
fee.
In boxing.
Yeah. So again, it's a human being thing, because the nature of the businesses are different, but they're remarkably similar.
It's true. And I think no matter what your role in this lifetime is, the greatest asset you can bring to the table is to always listen and then to make decisions upon the knowledge that you've just been gifted, so to speak, from the other person. Because it is a gift for someone wise in whatever industry you're dealing with to sit down with you and present to you what they believe you need to do to better yourself. It's a gift. You can't expect people to do that for you. And you've got to appreciate when it's done for you.
How long do you see yourself in the boxing world? You strike me, based on that last answer, as the kind of guy that likes to help younger talent or people you think are worthy of your help.
I like identifying and developing talent.
You can do that at any age, can't you?
It's true. And I've always said, like, along the journey with my development as a promoter, I'm going to give opportunities to younger guys who are fresh and hungry and want to better their lives. But they've got to be the right person for the job. Don't get me wrong. But I'm not in the business of keeping dinosaurs active. I want to develop my own talent, my own personnel, people that are hungry for their opportunities. And that's saying that will always be ingrained in me. I always want to... I don't like the word give back to the system because it's like someone trying to place themselves on a pedestal above everybody else. But I think it's important that you reflect what your own experiences were. And when I was coming up through the industry, it was very hard catching a break. I had to grind my way through the business. I had to knock down doors to make things happen. I don't think it should be that challenging for everybody who comes into the industry. I think that if I can identify someone's talent and I can utilize them within the greater structure of what I'm piecing together, then that's a person I'm going to give preference to deliver an opportunity to, because I know they'll always be appreciative of that opportunity. But to get back to your question, I'm not sure. I've never been fueled by money. So I could probably earn enough to go retire on a beach and I'd still be thinking professional boxing.
Well, it's obvious it's a passion of yours. The way you're talking about it, and then the fact of the answer that you just gave, and the fact that you would like to see it grow, you know, that to me tells me it's something you'll be involved with for a lifetime.
Possibly. It just depends how quickly the industry ages me, so to speak.
Well, if it ages you, my offer is still on the table. Let's go run weekly shows in Bendigo. Let's sink our life savings into it. Cracker Jack's interested. And yeah, we'll lose a lot of money. We won't talk to anybody else who's ever promoted wrestling because we don't want to be clouded by their negativity. And yeah, we'll go make $1 million, bro. It'll be awesome.
I'll contemplate returning to Bendigo. I just don't want to go back to the hotel I was last positioned in there when I was working for a professional boxing promoter. They put me in this hotel. There was no Wi-Fi. So 2015 and there's no Wi-Fi.
That sounds about right. That sounds like a company I know.
The owners looked like they were straight out of a horror script. And they had these parrots chirping the entire night. So I got a mediocre sleep, no Wi-Fi. The nearest store was about a 3-kilometer walk. And there was crazy owners. Perfect. So as long as we better our environment, I'm in for a quick tour. We'll see what proceeds thereafter. But retirement in Bendigo, I'm not too sure. Maybe, see, if you pitch to me like Mauritius, the Maldives, whatever, we can go start a company there. I don't even give a damn if we lose money. At least we'll be enjoying the scenery.
Let me call my boy Roy and we'll make that happen. Anything you want to plug?
Just MJA Entertainment, my promotional brand. So I've got the website launching real soon. It probably won't be launched by the time this podcast is up, but punch that in at Google, follow the company, follow the brand, and I'm sure in due course I'll be back on this platform, maybe for, what'd you say, this is season 3?
Yeah, season 3.
Maybe season 4 I'll be back discussing our promotional venture in anywhere in the world but Bendigo.
Well, it all depends. You got to make me your champ.
Here's where the action is. Hear Australia's favourite wrestlers. Here's where the action is. On Wrestle Radio Australia. Here's where the action is. action here. Whether you're a fan or part of the industry, Wrestle Radio Australia is here for you with four packed shows. WRA with Todd Eastman and Josh Armour. Axe Cast with Josh the Axe Shooter. Healing Out with Muhammad Ali Vaez. And Drawing Heat with Beej and the Dude.
Mr. Juicy Gino Gambino is here with us. Wrestlers love talking about themselves.
Do we ever.
Or hearing about them.
But honestly, when I used to do a podcast back in the day, we used to find the more shit we talked about people, the more listeners we got. Because I'd be like, can you believe they said that about you? And then they'd share it. It was awesome. And then I didn't get booked for 2 years. But that's a different story.
It's all free. Subscribe on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, or hear us at WrestleRadioAustralia.com. Wrestle Radio Australia. It's where the action is.
This is FNX.
A cocksucker would make people happy, wouldn't it?